Time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. Time is up. Time is up. Please hand your quizzes in. End of each row. This end. I'll come back down. Yeah. I'll take. Any quizzes done? If you have quizzes out there, bring them in, please. Okay. Take the whole minority. Minority interest is always a percentage that you don't know. Okay, folks, bring them. If you have quizzes out there, bring them in right now. So do you want to take them up to my office and just see if we can alphabetically sort them, or that's a whole file. So 170 is fine. Yeah, that'll be good because you have plenty of room. That's a good idea. Keep them as two separate files because they should be roughly already, right? That room should be ours. Okay, please settle in. Okay. I won't talk about the quiz, but same rules as the previous quiz. When it's ready, I'll let you know. You can come pick it up if you want to. I noticed half the first quizzes are still up there. So
I'll bring them back in. They'll go into recycling sooner rather than later. So it's up to you. So I want to mop up on intrinsic valuation, and I want to talk a little bit about valuing emerging market companies. So there are a few things on the agenda. So I'm going to start by talking about what it is that makes emerging market companies difficult to value. Remember the four questions: what are your cash flows from existing assets? What's the value of your growth? How risky are you? When will you be a mature company? You ask that about any company, right? But when you ask that about an emerging market company, an Indonesian company, a Brazilian company, a Russian company, here's the challenge you face. Every answer you give, the country is in the story, right? It's almost impossible to tell a story about a Brazilian company which doesn't bring in Brazil. It makes your life a lot more difficult because it's almost like you have to assess country risk as you're looking at every company. So what I'd like to talk about are a few things that you run into with emerging market companies, and some of you valuing emerging market companies, and what to do about it. First, country risk. It's always there, right? But when you're talking about emerging market companies, it's front and center. My advice is treat country risk with a bludgeon. Don't, you know, treat it with a scalpel, not with a bludgeon. Here's what I mean by that. Many analysts, when they think about country risk, put it everywhere. They use the government bond rate, which has country risk in it. They use a big equity risk premium. They reduce the cash flows. They change every input. You know? Keep it in one place so you know exactly what it is and bring it in. So when we talk about adjusting equity risk premiums for country risk and cleaning up the government bond rate, that's why we did it. Here's the second thing you're going to have to run into. You have to pick a currency to value, right? And if you have an emerging market company, that currency could be all over the place, up 30%, down 50%. And I think we spend way too much time sometimes thinking, well, what currency should I do the valuation? And here's why. Remember when we talked about currencies, I said, pick a currency, just be consistent. And I said, if you do that, your value will be the same whether you value a company in Russian rubles or euros. Now, part of you intellectually might get that, but you're saying, really? Is that going to happen? So I want to try to back it up. I don't know whether you're familiar with a company called Infosys, one of India's biggest outsourcing slash software companies. So about 4 years ago, I valued Infosys. I valued it initially in Indian rupees. So the second column, you see my valuation in Indian rupees. On that same day, with the same financial information, I valued it in US dollars. Same company, same point in time. So I'll tell you give you the good news and the bad news when I switch from rupees to dollars. Here's the good news. When you look at my rupee cost of capital, 12.5% upfront, moving to 10%, they become much lower when I do everything in US dollars. Tell me why again. Why when I move to rupees to dollars, does my cost of capital drop? No, wait. Country risk should be in no matter what currency I do it. So that, if that is the reason, then I'm in big trouble. I'm doing two separate valuations. It's difference in inflation, right? Basically, that's what's happening. I'm scaling it. So I have lower cost of capital in dollars. That's good news, right? Lower discount rate. But here's the bad news. See my growth rates, 12% and 5%. When I do everything in US dollars, those growth rates decrease. Again, why? Because of the same differential inflation. But here's the bottom line. The value per share that I got for Infosys was 614 rupees. On that very same day, if I had valued Infosys in US dollar terms, the value per share I'd have got would have been $12.79. If you converted the exchange rate that day, would have been exactly 614 rupees. So, feels almost like magic, right? But it's actually very simple. My inflation plays out my cash flows. My inflation plays out my discount rate. If I change the inflation the same way, it offsets. That's why you can get away picking any currency to value a company. It's because the inflation effect washes out. Any questions? It's actually a godsend because there are some currencies where doing valuation makes you uncomfortable because the risk-free rate is 15%. Building on top of that, this basically says when you're uncomfortable with the currency because you either can't get a risk-free rate in it, Pakistani rupees or Egyptian pounds, or you get a risk-free rate and you don't quite trust it, you can always value a company in an alternate currency. Third, I don't mean to pick on just emerging market companies because let's face it, corporate governance can be weak in any market. In fact, we could argue that since 2004, almost every company that has gone public in the US, which is a technology company, has really weak corporate governance. Why? What has almost every company since 2004 done when they went public? They were dual class of shares. It's the Google effect. Until Google came along, it wasn't common. So Google has dual class, Facebook, LinkedIn, Snap. You know, the only tech company that, the big tech company that's gone public since 2004 that has not adopted a dual class? Twitter. And what did Elon Musk do this morning? Take a 9.2% position in Twitter. That's a good thing because it means that you can change. It's not that I want Elon Musk running Twitter because I'm not sure he wants, so it'd be a good match. Yeah. But I think in a sense, a company needs shaking up and they can be shaken up because they don't have dual class of shares. Jack Dorsey doesn't own a controlling stake in Twitter. He cannot stop change if it comes because it ended up two class of shares. But it's true, corporate governance can be weak in some companies and strong in others. Remember, this was one of the start of the class test and we said, should we apply a discount? What did we conclude? Should you apply a discount or not? If you do it right, it should already be in there, right? Why? Because if you have bad corporate governance, what does it mean? You can't change the way the company is run. So if it's badly managed and badly run, it stays badly managed and run. So I'm going to use an example. It's an Indian company called Tube Investments. It's actually a very old family-controlled company. It's a very conservatively run company in many ways. So this was a few years ago, probably about 10, 15 years ago. A value Tube Investment. I'll take you through the story in this valuation. You tell me what troubles you about the story. This is a growing company. It's reinvesting a lot. Its reinvestment rate last year was 113%. And even if you smoothed out, it's reinvesting a lot. That's good, right? It's making a 9.2% return on capital. That, if it were a US company, it'd be a pretty good return. But at the time that I did this, the Indian rupee risk-free rate was 12%, and the cost of capital was 16.9%. I'm telling a story of a company that is growing, but growing by taking projects that earn less than the cost of capital. And in this valuation, guess what I've done? I've left the return on capital below the cost of capital, not just for the next 2 years, not just for the next 5 years, but forever. I've created a perpetual value-destroying machine. The reason is it's family controlled and the family doesn't seem to see this as a problem. They say, we're making money. They are making money, but they're not making enough money to cover the cost of capital. But because they don't see this as a problem, they're never going to fix it. So in my original valuation, think of this as the status quo. I've left it at 61 rupees per share because that's the value I get, assuming the company continues to be run there. But let's say the family wakes up and says, this is terrible. We need to make the company more valuable. They decide to hire you as the CEO to run the company. What's the first thing you're going to do the day you walk in? What's the first thing you're going to try to fix? I mean, it's tough to fix past investments that are bad investments, right? Those investments are kind of stuck. But starting today, at least, you might say, look, I'm going to stop taking projects that are really bad. Maybe I'll settle for just bad projects. Let's not get our ambitions up. Good projects might not even be in the rep, but I would think you'd want to take less bad projects. So let's move in the right direction. What does that mean? So 9.2%, what if you could make 12.2%, still lower than the cost of capital? You're moving towards your cost of capital. Look at the value per share. It goes from 62 to 84 rupees. If you go from 12.2% to 16.2%, in other words, you just take zero net present value projects, the value per share will go to 120 rupees per share. If you believe corporate governance works, you're going to try to move towards a 120 because that's what makes sense over time, that you stop taking bad projects. But if corporate governance is dead in this company, I'm going to be very reluctant to pay more than 60 or 70 rupees per share because I have no idea whether the company will ever get fixed and there's no pressure from outside to get it fixed. So you get to come in as CEO, the first thing you do is you fix new projects, you try to get it. What's the next thing you're going to do? You're going to go look at your old projects and see if you can improve the return. And that's a lot more work. But if you can improve the returns on existing projects, you get another added value because now you get that improvement, the efficiency growth from taking existing projects and running them better. I don't know whether you can try this on Twitter. I mean, let's face it, Twitter has been a disaster as a business. It's always had lots of users. It's amazingly, it's in every aspect of our lives. When do you read a news story that's, I mean, in fact, I think New York Times reporters get their news breaking on Twitter, right? That's where you find out. Now I want to see MLB trades. I don't go to MLB.com. It shows up on Twitter before MLB knows it. I've never seen a platform that's so much in our lives and so little to show for it in terms of business success. Be interesting to do a Twitter valuation status quo. And I think right now the company still hasn't figured it out. And a Twitter valuation, if somebody could come in and convert it into a business model. Very
That's
similar.
Too far away.
Yeah, go ahead.
Have a good one. I mean, yeah.
Whatever. So I think somebody's got their mic open. So
sorry.
Hey, whoever's got your mic open, can you turn it off? Cross Holdings. Of all the things you prepared for in the quiz, what was the part that you found most messy? It's a stupid minority interest, minority holdings. You subtract, you add, you multiply, you divide. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's the part of valuation that drives people crazy. Because there's so many things you can screw up on. Now, cross holdings are not just unique to emerging market companies, but you run into them more in emerging market companies because in so many emerging markets, you got family groups. And you kind of ignore cross holdings because they're not just 2, 3, 4% of the company. They can be 20 or 30 or 40% of a company. So again, I'm going to draw on an Indian example because India is full of family group companies. And I'm going to take one of India's best known family groups. It's called the Tata Group. And I'm looking at four Tata companies, Tata Chemicals, Tata Steel, Tata Steel, Tata Chemicals, Tata Motors, and Tata Consulting Services, all part of the family group. They're all independent, publicly traded companies, but they're all within the family. Now, don't even try to read what's in this page. I've done a full DCF valuation of each one. And after I took the present value, the cash flows, the cost of capital, I had to clean up for cross holdings with each company. I'll cut to the chase. This is what I wanted to focus on. I looked at what percentage of my value per share in each of these four companies came from their cross holdings. So see this blue part? That's what I get when I take free cash flow of the firm discounted the cost of capital. This is what we spent, 12 sessions talking about this class. That gets you the blue part. The red part is my cross holdings. And notice that in Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals, half of what you're paying for the company comes from their cross holdings. This could make or break your valuation. And the problem is it's all blurry, right? You can't do a full-fledged analysis because you're looking at things you cut, you know, bunches of other Tata companies. Tata Consulting Services has only a sliver of its value coming from cross-holdings. Why do you think that is? Somebody, if you're familiar with the Tata Group, right, even if you're not, maybe you can hazard a guess as to why. So much less of TCS comes from cross holdings and so much more of Tata Motors, Tata Steel, and Tata Chemicals comes from cross holdings. Anybody want to give that a shot? Yeah. That could be, that's a good answer, but I don't think it really explains the huge divergence, right? Because I could, as TCS, go out and buy all kinds of things up and down my vertical chain as well. I think that's a variant of the same answer, right? To understand what's going on here, let's go back 50 years. These family groups were all privately owned then. There were no publicly traded companies. So let's say it's 1975. The Tata family owns all these companies 100%, Tata Motors, Tata Steel. And let's say Tata Steel needs to build a new plant and it doesn't have the money, but Tata Motors had a really good year. Family owns all of the companies, right? So what's the family going to do? It's going to take money out of Tata Motors put it into Tata Steel, and the accounting then would give, you know, because you got to make the balance sheet balance, and because they took money out, they will give Tata Motors these notional shares. At that time, you know, who cared about the shares? They were all privately owned. CCY, those three, they're old companies. They've been around 70, 80, 90 years. TCS was formed in the late 1980s. By then, all the other companies were already public. The reason for capital, this isn't some gigantic conspiracy to get you. That's not why these, this is a reflection of these companies' history. And because TCS has been around a lot less, it hasn't had the chance to accumulate all of this other holdings in other companies. If you take a look at the Samsung Group, the electronics, the technology companies in the Samsung Group have relatively small cross holdings. But the parts of the Samsung Group that are manufacturing that go back 30, 40, 50 years have much bigger cross holdings. Same phenomenon play out. Which brings me to a final point. Now, we talked a little bit about truncation risk last session in the context of distressed companies, right? Now, what did we do? We took an expected value. An expected value, what the value of this company would be assuming it makes it, and the value of the company assuming liquidation. When you're valuing emerging market companies, the types of truncation risk become much more plentiful. I remember there was an Egyptian publicly traded company that owned a hotel, a five-star hotel in Egypt, which was attacked by terrorists. Because I don't know when, you know, 8-9 years ago. The entire hotel was burned to the ground. And they had no insurance. You know why? Because buying insurance in those parts of the world is so expensive that they actually paid for the insurance, you'd never make it. But overnight, the company essentially went from being this pretty profitable hotel company to nothing. It's natural disasters. You could have nationalization, something you would not expect to see in Europe or the US, but in some emerging markets, the government can one day say, look, you're a nice lucrative company, we're going to take you over. You can have political upheaval where a government gets displaced. When it gets displaced, all kinds of things happen to companies in that market. It's truncation risk. So I'm going to use a company to illustrate truncation risk that I think kind of isolates what I'm talking about. You've all heard of Aramco, right? It's a Saudi Arabian oil company. Until 2019, Aramco was 100% owned by the Saudi government, actually by the Saudi royal family, because you know, you don't know where the government ends and the royal family begins. And in 2019, they finally went public. It's an IPO where the minute the IPO was done, this company became the most valuable company in the world in terms of market cap. At that time, Apple had a market cap of 1.4 trillion, I think. Overnight, this company had became the largest. So it was a huge IPO. So I decided to value Aramco. And Aramco, in a sense, is the easiest of all companies to value. Because what are you getting when you buy Aramco? You're getting 330 million barrels of oil under the Saudi sands. We know pretty well how much reserves there are. We know that these are really low cost reserves. So I decided to value Aramco. My first round, I took a very simplistic route. At the time of the IPO, the Saudi government promised to pay at least 75% of its earnings. So it actually put a floor in its payout ratio and said, we'll have a payout ratio of 75% plus. So what I did my initial valuation is I took the earnings, applied this guaranteed payout ratio, and came up with the value for the company of about 1.63 trillion. Amazing how. And here's the other difference. Remember in all my valuations, I stopped in year 10 and computed a terminal value. Here, I just took the cash flows over the next 50 years. You're saying, why 50 years? That's how many, if I take out the number of barrels of oil that I need to get to the cash flows, in 50 years, there'll be nothing left in the ground. At the end of 50 years, there is no terminal value. There's no salvage value. What are you going to salvage? The sand, right? Nobody's going to buy that. So what I have is the present value of dividends for the next 50 years. And it's amazing how lucrative that cash flow stream is, 1.63 trillion. So based on the dividend discount model, the value per share for the company just collecting the dividends is 1.63 trillion. Now, what's your concern when you use the dividend discount model? The company might be paying out dividends it cannot afford, right? So just to do my due diligence, I computed the free cash flow to equity. Aramco, saying, look, let's see how much cash flow the company has. And guess what? They can pay 90% of their earnings as dividends. They actually have higher cash flows. You could argue that this is now a riskier stream because it's not guaranteed by the government. So I adjusted for that with a higher discount rate. But the bottom line is the value that I got was roughly the same, about 1.6 trillion. So with both the dividend discount model and the cash flow model, I'm coming up with the value of about 1.6 trillion. You should be ready to pull the trigger, right? That's the value per share. But there's one thing that is worrying me here. Here's what it is. When you buy Aramco, you're not buying just another publicly traded oil company. You're buying a country. You know what I mean by that? 80% of Saudi Arabia's GDP comes from oil, and Aramco produces it all. You're buying Saudi Arabia Inc. when you buy Aramco. I know I'm not quite done. Because Saudi Arabia has this very strange structure. It's viewed as the property of the House of Saud. So you're actually buying a country, and then if you think a little deeper, you're buying a piece of the royal family. You're making a bet. What's a bet? That the House of Saud is going to protect your earnings and cash flows for the next 50 years. Is there a chance that bet could go bad? Remember in 2008 when Hosni Mubarak was, you know, dictator for life in Egypt and said, nobody can ever get him out. That's he's there for the rest of his life. In 2009, of course, he's, you know, there's a revolution, he's overthrown, and everything about Egypt changes. I'm not saying that is imminent in Saudi Arabia, so don't take this as some political prediction, but I'm saying when you buy Aramco, you're making a bet that this existing status quo will continue for 50 years. So I asked a what if question. What if there's a chance of a regime change? And if there is a regime change, that regime could be less friendly to me in terms of earnings and cash flows than the House of Saud. They don't even have to nationalize the company, right? All they have to do, and oil companies struggle with this all the time, is when you're producing oil in a country, the country can define a royalty per barrel of oil. Venezuela, for instance, quadrupled what it demanded from oil companies when Hugo Chavez first came into office. I said, what if a new government comes in? And remember now they can say, you're all public shareholders in the company, but you know what? You should be paying twice as much. Effectively, they can undercut your earnings and cash flows because they can control how much you take away. So I made two assumptions. And you could argue they're completely arbitrary because I'm not a political scientist. I said, there is a chance of regime change. And if I'm looking at a 50-year period, even if it's a really small chance, it's going to accumulate over time. I'm going to put a 20% probability of regime change. And if that happens, I'm going to get half the cash flows I predict. I make a confession. I'm completely making up this crap, right? 20%, half, how do you know that? But if your response is, because I don't know that, I'm going to ignore it, are you making an assumption too? You're ignoring it. What are you saying? There's 0% chance of a regime change and nothing will happen. You know what? I'll take my kind of back of the envelope assumptions over that one. What I'm trying to say is sometimes people think that if they don't assume something, that they're not making an assumption. You are making an assumption, and I think sometimes it's better to make your best guess rather than let it be zero and let it roil your valuation. So emerging market companies, you can already see why things get a little tricky. Let's move to the next group of companies. Until 2008, when I got to this session of this class, to talk about valuing banks and financial service companies, I used to make a statement that I still haven't lived down because it's kind of saved in recordings for posterity. I used to say valuing banks is easy. I don't believe that anymore, but I'll tell you why I used to say that. It was built on two assumptions. The first was that banks were run by sensible people. And the second was that the regulators who regulated banks actually did their jobs and made sure banks didn't do anything. I believe that, you know, at least in the US and Europe, that that's what was the truth. You're saying, what does that buy? Think about what you face as a challenge when you value banks. When I ask you, what are your cash flows? How do we compute cash flows? We start with earnings, we subtract our net capex and change in working capital. Try doing that for a bank. I challenge you. You're going to get the earnings, but then what? What's CapEx for a bank? What about depreciation? What about working capital? You could argue everything is working capital. Nothing is working capital. You're going to spend days and weeks, and in the end, you're going to say, I don't know what the cash flow is. When I ask you what's the value created by future growth, you're going to face the same struggle. You can't figure out what they're reinvesting in. How can you tell me whether these projects are good projects or bad projects? With risk, what are you going to look at? There's no debt to equity ratio you can come up for a bank because defining debt is almost impossible. So for the longest time, desperation was the response that people had when they tried cash flow models. When you can't estimate cash flows, what's the only thing you have left that you can discount? You discount dividends. Now do you see why you have to assume the banks are run by sensible people? Because we assume that if they're run by sensible people, what they pay out is dividends, is what they can afford to pay out. That's the trust that drives the dividend discount model. And the dividend discount model makes your life simple, right? Because to estimate dividends, here's what you need. You need to project out net income. You can make assumptions about growth. You need to estimate a payout ratio. You can estimate those two things. Payout ratio times earnings becomes dividend. This is actually a dividend discount model valuation of an Egyptian bank called CIB. It's in 2015, Egyptian pounds. And I had to do some gymnastics to get there because there was no government bond rate to get an Egyptian pound risk-free rate. So I took the US T-bond rate, which is a dollar risk-free rate, and added the differential inflation. Remember that shortcut that you can use? But here were the drivers of that. This is a growing Egyptian bank. So what I do is I put in the growth rate. And if you don't be too dazzled by the growth rate, because it's all in Egyptian pounds, the inflation rate was sky high. In fact, the risk-free rate was 10.5%. So it's still impressive, but not as impressive as it looks. So for the first 5 years, I have really high growth and a really low payout ratio, 25%. I'm okay with that. If you're going to grow 32%, pay out 25%, that's a pretty good combination. But here's where consistency comes in. As my growth rate decreases after year five, what should happen to my payout ratio to be consistent? It needs to go up because if you're growing, you know, at a lower rate, you should be needing to reinvest less. So everything we talked about in traditional valuation applies, but I'm using the payout ratio. You know how we change reinvestment rates over time? I'm changing the payout ratio to. The bottom line is if I have earnings and payout ratios, I can get expected dividends. Discounting those dividends back at my, look at the cost of equity in Egyptian pounds and get used to seeing cost of equity like this when you're looking at high inflation currencies. Gives me a value per share of 42 pounds. The stock was actually trading at 36 pounds. I actually tried to buy shares in this. It's almost impossible to do. If you're not Egyptian, actually, I went through different brokerage houses, almost impossible to get. But again, it's a very basic dividend discount model, and you can see why you're assuming that the bank is run by sensible people because you're taking the dividends as what the company can afford to pay. So let me start by making a statement. Banks are incredibly opaque institutions. If you don't believe me, pick up a 10K for a bank. It'll run what, thousand, remember Citigroup is 1,000 pages. It's amazing how little they tell you over 1,000 pages. There are things you'd like to know. You have all these loans. Can you break them down by how much past due they are? They don't give you that breakdown. They might give you a bad debt provision, but the basic theme behind banks is trust us. And the reason we trusted them historically is they were looked over by the regulator. We assumed that the regulators were doing their job. And that's why we've let them get by not giving us the information. But the reality is that when you use the dividend discount model, that trust is kind of playing behind the surface. Remember the Wells Fargo growth rate computation we did when we did the sustainable, where, you know, 2008 hit and you tried to adjust the regulatory capital up and the return on equity down. So when September 2008 happened, banking crisis, I started to get more and more uncomfortable with both my assumptions. First, the regulators clearly hadn't done their job, right? Otherwise the banks wouldn't have been able to do what they did. And I realized very quickly that banks are run by some of the least sensible people on the face of the earth. They're driven so much by inertia that they hate to cut dividends. You could be in the midst of a meltdown at the bank, but they're still paying dividends. I still remember in 2009, major bank CEO, I asked him, why are you continuing to pay dividends? With regulatory capitalism in the toilet. You need new capital, you keep paying dividends. That's violating the first rule of getting out of a hole, right? When you're in a hole, stop digging and you're digging deeper. You know what he said? We can't cut dividends because it'll send the wrong signal. I said, what universe are you in? Every day I open up the newspaper, what do I see? A story about another bank melting down. You're worried about sending a bad signal by cutting dividends? In fact, by not cutting dividends, you're sending the signal that you're in complete denial. So I've struggled with how to value banks without using the dividend discount model. And I'll tell you the opening I used. When we valued non-financial service companies so far, notice I never kept track of the book equity of the company. I might have used it up front to do a return on equity, but then after that, I just threw it away. Why? Because I really don't care what the book equity looks like for a non-financial service company. In fact, for young companies, what happens to book equity? It becomes negative, and I say, who cares? But with banks, you have to care, and here's why. The way banks are regulated is with a regulatory capital. They need to maintain a regulatory capital ratio. So there's this document called the Basel Accords, and goes back decades, which lists out, if you have this kind of business, this is how much you need to maintain in regulatory capital. And then bankers being bankers, they slice and dice, and they have tier one, tier two, tier three, all of which are incredibly boring, but all of which are built on book equity as a starting point. So if I'm a bank and something ruinous happens to book equity, like what? Like a trader loses 5 billion, like SocGen traded it. That comes out of book equity. I have a really bad year. I've got to write off a $10 billion. That comes out of book equity. And when my regulatory capital drops, it can drop to a point where I'm in serious danger. The regulators can step in and stop me. Doesn't mean I have to go bankrupt. I have to go out and raise fresh equity. So I said, if for a bank, what's the equivalent of CapEx is what you need to reinvest in regulatory capital. And already you can see this allows me to differentiate between high growth banks and low growth banks. A high growth bank needs to reinvest more, so it'll be able to pay less in dividends. That kind of makes sense. An undercapitalized bank, bank which has too low a capital ratio, will have to reinvest more just to can pay less dividends. And if you're undercapitalized enough, you could actually end up with a negative cash flow because you need to come up with so much money. So I'm going to apply this. And here's what I'm going to do. My estimate of free cash flow to equity for a bank is I'll start with net income like I do for any other company. But instead of subtracting out net capex and changing working capital, I'm going to estimate how much you'll need to reinvest in regulatory capital. So I'll use one of my favorite examples here. You all heard of Deutsche Bank, right? When I think of Deutsche Bank, I think of that teenager in a horror movie. You know what I'm talking about? He or she always opens the door to the basement. It's completely dark down there. You can hear the sound of a chainsaw down there. And what does this teenager do? Decides to walk down just to check to see what is going on. Nothing good comes out of this. Deutsche is like that teenager. Since 2008, every year it opens the door to the basement, goes down and gets chopped up and then comes back up again. Said, I never saw that coming. So this was in October of 2016. I did a valuation of Deutsche. I'll send you the link to this blog post. And I picked a title for the post. I said, it's a Greek tragedy at a German bank. And I chose the words intentionally. You know how the Germans look down on the Greeks, right? They say, you're so undisciplined. You don't know how to run anything. And I said, this is, what's that German word? Schadenfreude, right? You go around pointing fingers at other people. Here you have the ultimate German institution, Deutsche Bank, behaving like one of those Greeks you complain about, completely undisciplined. In October 2016, Deutsche Bank was a basket case. It had a $15 billion fine that had been imposed on it by the US Justice Department was something it did in 2008. Tell me again what happens when you have a fine? It comes out of your book equity, right? That pushed the regulatory capital ratio down to 12.4%, well below what they even they said would be a safe rate. In fact, if you looked at the typical money center bank, the ratio is like 15.67%. They were undercapitalized. They were losing tons of money. So remember, every time you lose billions, it comes out. So they were in serious trouble. In fact, they were in so much trouble that there were news stories floating around that the German government might have to take Deutsche into receivership. It sounds absolutely unbelievable, but the Royal Bank of Scotland, after the 2008 crisis, for a year, 2 years, I don't know how long it had to be taken off the market. It doesn't mean they shut down, but the government steps in because you can't let a bank go bankrupt. So I decided to value Deutsche Bank. So I put my optimist hat on. And here's what I did. First, I plotted a pathway for them to get back to making money. Right now, the return on equity is minus 13.7%. I said over time, the return equity will improve to 9.44%. That sounds awfully precise. 9.44% is their cost of equity. So over time, I'm assuming that the best they can do is get their return equity up to their cost of equity. So as the return equity improves, my losses become profits. Half my salvation for Deutsche Bank has already been put into motion. But to get to that income, what do they need to do? They need to fix their regulatory cap, right? It's too low. So the second thing I did was I estimated how much they would need to bring in regulatory capital every year to get to that 15.67%. So here's what I have is free cash or equity. I take the net income or loss, subtract out the change in regulatory capital. That's like net capex or working capital. And I come up with the free cash flow equity. Take a look at the free cash flow equity in year one, minus 11.6 billion. I'm being a realist here. I'm saying for Deutsche to survive and become this healthy bank, it needs to bring in 11.6 billion in equity next year. So in fact, free cash flow equity is negative for the next 4 years, and then they turn positive. So think of this as potential dividend, but I'm estimating it for a bank. You discount those cash flows back, the value per share that I got was 23. But I then stop and ask, what's the chance that this will not happen? I attach only a 10% chance of failure. You know why so low? This looks like a basket case bank, right? Because it is, in fact, too big to let that happen. Because if you think about it, when Lehman went down, think of how many, the tentacles, right? Every other bank was sucked down because banks have relationships with each other. Can you imagine if Deutsche Bank goes down, how many other banks will go down with it? So you know what's going to happen. If they're in enough trouble, you'll see a lot of helping hands, not because these people want to save Deutsche, but because they want to save themselves. If this had been a much smaller bank, that probably would have been closer to 40 or 50%, because when small banks get into trouble, the regulators actually then require them to be acquired by healthier banks. And you're saying, why would a healthier bank do it? They just hold a gun to the head of the healthier bank and say, you acquire that country. So there's no question of, I don't want to do it. This is one of the downsides of being in a heavily hit rate. So my value per share was 2067. I actually bought the shares at 13. I got lucky. They had a rights issue in the next year to raise about 12 billion. You know what a rights issue is? Basically, they allow you to buy shares at a discounted price. And when they have a rights issue, you can actually sell your rights. If you do. So I basically cashed out most of my investment with that rights issue. Thank God for that. Because 3 years later, guess what the stock price was? It's like $7 per share. Because they'd found another new horror story to get themselves into. And another chainsaw showed up. I'm giving up hope. I think that there is this built-in urge for Deutsche to self-destruct. And they're going to keep trying this over and over again. One final point, and then I'll end. When you think about financial service companies, you tend to think about banks. You might think about investment banks. But there's a whole new set of financial service companies coming through in the tech space, fintech. Many of them are intermediaries. Okay? Let's take PayPal. How does PayPal make money? Or Venmo. They don't actually do it. They're platforms. You have transactions on the platform. They get a small piece of whatever happens in the platform. Last year, I valued this Indian payment processor called Paytm. It's It's an online company. It went public with a huge amount of fanfare. Largest stockholder in Paytm is actually, I think, was it Alipay? And it's basically almost a Hong Kong owned company, a lot of VCs in Hong Kong and Chinese companies. But Paytm's big selling point is they have 330 million Indians on their platform. This is the advantage of being an Indian or a Chinese company, is the number of people is going to be mind blowing. You're never going to get a Polish company with 330 million people on its platform, because where are you going to find 330 million people? They have 330 million people. Immense amount of transactions on the platform. This is good news, right? But what these companies keep is a percentage of that. It's called the take rate. So think MasterCard, Visa. Think of them as the older versions of it. Whenever you use a Visa and you pay $100, Visa keeps a slice of that. It's like 2%. That's a take rate. Paytm's take rate was 0.79%. So your task is laid out for you. This company has an immense platform, lots of transactions, but their take rate is incredibly low. So when I valued Paytm, I had to forecast out what that take rate would become. So if you get a chance, take a look at the Paytm, because some of you are valuing financial service companies that derive their value by keeping a slice of something happening on the platform. And anytime you have an intermediary business, you might want to start with the gross value that goes to the platform and say, what is my take rate going to be? Because your story might be about the take rate, how it can improve or not improve over time. It's going to have a huge impact on value. So I will see you on Wednesday. Yes.
So your DCF
recommendation. Yeah.
You know that with the cement, which might still be okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.